I will hear from wrong, and I'll die in your
sense. Welcome to our booth.
And this ought to show it right here.
Do you or someone you know suffer from depression? If so, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Defender 7 Tuesday Night Medical Broadcast with your host, our Colonel, Kimberly Purvis. And just to let you know, we may have a little bit of technical difficulty during the show. We'll know more as soon as I bring Kimberly on. But before we get started, let me read the disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on Defenders Radio Show and Facebook page are those of the callers and or authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Defenders 7. Now, for all those of you that are new just tuning into us, we are a humanitarian American Patriot Group, LLC, organization. We operate strictly on donations and sales from our store. We have a website. If you type in all lowercase letters, www.defenders, Roman numeral V as in Victor, with two small I's, .com. You'll find that we have our store and a donate button. 100% of all proceeds from the sales from our store and any money we receive via donation go back to our communities throughout all 50 states in a time of need or in any shit hits the fan situation. So please, by all means, purchase something or hit that donate button. Every bit helps, and that's the only way that we're able to do what we do. So help us to help you and your communities in time of need. We can be reached on our national Facebook page by typing in the search box, all capital letters, Defenders 7. That's Defenders, Roman numeral V as in Victor, two large I's. Just know, before you hit that join button, that we expect all of our members and future members to participate in everything we do throughout the Defender 7. If you get in and you feel that it's not for you, you can leave with no hard feelings. We here at the Defender 7 consider ourselves one big extended family, not just a group. So by all means, check us out. And speaking of the donations and other ways you can help us, share our shows, like our page, our Blog Talk radio station page. Share it on every social media platform for us. If you cannot donate or purchase something, that's helping us to help you. And also our Colonel, Kimberly Purvis, also has our YouTube page and channel set up. Go on there and hit subscribe. Help us out that way also. We're also on MeWe, If you type in Defender 7, click organizations, and scroll down to Defenders 7 Humanitarian American Patriot Group. And as always, on all of our shows that we do here live on Blog Talk, this is your radio station. We're always looking for topics. So please, this is your station. If you're too stage fright to get on, that's fine. Give us some topics to discuss. That's all we're asking. And tonight's show and all of our shows, we enjoy it if you can call in. And that number to call, area code 914-205-5773. Again, the number to call, area code 914-205-5773. Show your support, people. Come on, call in, click, like our pages, like our Blog Talk show, share it out there on all social media platforms, and boom, you're already helping. I'm now opening up the phone lines and welcoming your host, our Colonel, and dancing Miss Lorna Munson, a.k.a. Slacker.
Ah, Miss Wisconsin.
Good evening.
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. How y'all doing?
Not too bad. I'm enjoying the rain, actually.
I was enjoying the 89-degree weather we had.
Yeah,
we had the rain
here
Friday on and off.
Also, like I was saying before last night's show, Tanner's voice, I will be in court with the family and the podcaster that's covering and a strong advocate of Mrs. Michelle Barton, and I'm going to, with their permission, I'm going to go Facebook Live on Friday from the courthouse before and after the show, or after the court. So stay tuned for that. If they won't allow me to go live, then there will be plenty of pictures.
For the YouTube channel, I got a friend of mine on TikTok. He has an American flag that's hanging up. It's the outside of his house, and he's doing the Pledge of Allegiance. And I asked him if I could use it for a YouTube channel, and he's like, "Go ahead." So
awesome!
I didn't want to use. Huh?
You actually have friends?
What? Shut up. See, I didn't want to just use any old, you know, because I wanted to make sure we got permission to use a video on there if it's not ours. Because they asked
right.
If you got permission. So later on tonight or tomorrow, I'm going to get on there. And what I'm going to try and do, I want to do is like little 5 to 10 minute videos on our Blog Talk shows, like do a history of like we did the vaccine, do a little
right.
one like that, and like a medical one. I'd rather do the political one if we could do a live one, but it. That's going to have to be something that we practice and because I have no idea how to hook up more than one person that's not on the same YouTube.
Right.
My a friend, he was in a military, and he has a veterans YouTube channel. And that dude talks about everything. It doesn't matter what it is. And he used to be a history teacher, and he does a lot about the Constitution and everything else, but I don't know how he did it, and I need to get in touch with him somehow and ask him how in the hell he did it. So, if not, I'll just keep farting with it.
Yeah.
But other than that...
One thing you want to do with the guy that's going to allow you to use his background stuff, you might want to get him to write you a little note giving you permission to use it.
Yep.
This way,
well, I mean, I asked him. It's on the messenger, but...
But that's not... him writing a letter is better. This way...
I'll just give him my email address and have him email me a little letter that says I give them permission to use it. Because I explained to him it was our Patriot group. And we're veterans and civilian, you know, we saw that in kind of a little bit of a brief, you know, and he said no problem. But anyways, I'll ask him before I put it on there.
Yeah, because I just hate to see it come back and bite us.
Oh, I know. So last night we were, we almost covered all of the history of vaccines. We got to 1864. So we can go ahead and finish that up and then get into, the other subject. So in 1864, French doctors investigate an animal vaccine. So awareness of the danger of the spread of the diseases such as syphilis via arm-to-arm transmission of vaccine virus began to grow in France. Several doctors having read of the Neapolitan practice of serial vaccination of calves with varicella. Had a vaccinated calf shipped to Paris where it was used as a source of vaccine. And the use of calves for vaccine material came to be widespread. So not only in France, but in other parts of Europe and in the United States, Great Britain, Great Britain, however, they did not adopt the practice until 1881. And then they finally banned the arm-to-arm transmission in 1898. Well, dang, got it. All right. I got my technical difficulties fixed, but now I'm going to other problems. So in 1865, the disease of silkworms, Pasteur accepted a task to investigate a disease of the silkworm that was ravaging France's silk industry. Pasteur, never having handled a silkworm, traveled to the south of France to investigate. And after that, he isolated the microorganisms causing the disease. And then this work contributed to Pasteur's interest in infectious disease. So he had already been just a doctor before. I didn't know, like, Pasteur, I thought he only did vaccines. Or like a virologist. I didn't know he had been a doctor, too. And so in 1865, Pasteur's daughter had passed away from a liver tumor. In 1866, Bogency vaccine strain begun. Leanne Henry DePaul, the director of vaccination for the French Academy of Medicine, traveled to Bogency, France. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Where he observed a cow that had been inoculated with spontaneously occurring cowpox from one cow to another. And from those vesicles, he gathered the lymph and inoculated a cow that he had brought with him. And then he had returned to Paris with the inoculated cow and used its resulting lymph for vaccination, thus ensuring a fully animal vaccine strain. According to the American physician, thus was inaugurated the method of true and undoubted animal vaccination, and this vaccine stock came to be known as the Bogency stock, which was widely propagated in Europe and America. To think that they used animals back in the day, right, to practice on, and nobody complained about it. And today, I mean, don't get me wrong, I understand some of the animal testing that goes on is kind of bad. Let's skip that one. Dang, got it. So in 1870, the animal vaccine was brought to the United States. This looks familiar. I thought I already read this one. Boston physician Henry Austin Martin brought what he called true animal vaccine to the United States. He described how he procured the material. His special agent from Paris with ample supplies of animal virus were in tubes and on ivory points and squares of glass collected and sealed by Professor DePaul in his presence. And then he signed directions from the same distinguished savant. Sorry, my dogs are barking. And a full collection of pamphlets and other publications from Professor DePaul and others. So they returned to Boston on the 23rd of September in 1870 and secured the use of a farm on which was a herd of nearly 50 young cows. And on the very day that of the person's return, they vaccinated three of them. And then on the next day, they did two, and on every day he did two until they finished. And, of course, put in possession of ample supplies of animal lymph and devoted himself to daily vaccinations of infants. So he said his price, his work, however, came with a price. It involved great labor and responsibility, considerable odium, large expenditure, and in various ways, infinite annoyance, insult, and wrong, which has now passed favor. And I can only endeavor to forget as soon as my experiment had proved a success, there were not wanting those eagerly rushed into competition with me. This I expected and hailed some of these competitors as fellow workers in a field where much was to be done. I gave them every aid in my power freely, frankly and fully. So it's good back then. They knew they had to find a cure for the vaccine, and it'd be okay to share everything they knew. And today, nobody wants to share their knowledge because they're afraid they're going to be outdone. So in 1874, German vaccination law came around. A compulsory smallpox vaccination and revaccination law went into effect in Germany. Over the next few decades, smallpox deaths dropped rapidly. After the law of 1874 went into the effect, the annual mortality in Prussia fell so that between 1875 and 86, the average mortality per 100,000 was only 1.91. On the other hand, in Austria, where the lax vaccination and revaccination, it didn't change. They didn't, I don't want to say force them, but you know, encouraged it. So, but in 1897, there were about five deaths from this disease in the entire German Empire with a population of 54 million. That's not bad for smallpox to drop that much back then. Oh, crap. Damn it. Sorry. So in 1876, efforts to increase vaccine production, the New York Board of Health established a vaccine farm in Lakeview, New Jersey. Lymph from calves infected with cowpox virus was harvested and then used as a vaccine. So the use of animal lymph reduced transmission of human illnesses such as leprosy and syphilis. Huh. The white strain of vaccine was later derived from this vaccine. That's amazing that they were able to get a vaccine for leprosy and syphilis out of cowpox. They were pretty smart back then. So in 1877, anthrax investigations had begun. So having begun his studies on anthrax earlier in the year, in the midst of an epidemic that was devastating livestock, Louis Pasteur presented a paper on the disease to the Academy of Sciences, and that investigation was the beginning of his work in medicine. Just as some of Pasteur's colleagues embraced the idea of spontaneous generation, many of them rejected the idea that microbes played a role in the disease. In the case of anthrax, they thought that toxic plants biting insects, the sun, or hot weather might cause the disease. Pasteur confirming work published earlier by Robert Koch showed that anthrax bacilli were the agent of the disease. You know, I had no idea anthrax was that far back. Did you?
No.
I thought it was something new. I mean, like in the 1900s or a little bit
right.
later, you know. I had no idea.
No.
Oh.
I mean, I thought when I heard it, I thought that that was, you know, that era, you know, our era.
Yeah. Like after 1950 is when, because you didn't hear about it.
No.
Well, I mean, I was born in 71, so what am I going to hear about? But even still, in the 80s and 90s, I guess that's probably when it came out the most. You know, it's kind of like buying a new car. You never saw that car until you wanted to buy it, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's everywhere. Same thing with vaccines. Until you start studying, then you know they're everywhere. But Pasteur also demonstrated that another type of bacteria could cause sepsis, also which is known as blood poisoning. And yellow fever strikes again, this time in 1878, yellow fever cripples the Mississippi Valley, and it killed more than 13,000 people in the lower Mississippi Valley at the time. It was one of the worst medical disasters in U.S. history. The following year, a federal government commission investigated the disaster. Marine Hospital Service Surgeon General John Woodward reported to Congress that yellow fever should be dealt with as an enemy which imperils life and cripples commerce and industry. So in 1878, the Native American tribes were affected again. The Yuma tribe along the Gila River in southern Arizona had a measles outbreak that killed a lot of children in one year. but it doesn't say how many. Okay. In 1879, the first laboratory vaccine had started. Louis Pasteur produced the first laboratory-developed vaccine, the vaccine for chicken cholera. Wow. Chickens that get cholera. Pasteur attenuated or weakened the bacteria for use in the vaccine. He happened upon the method of attenuation by accident in his lab. He was studying fowl cholera by injecting chickens with the live bacteria and recording the fatal progression of the illness. He had instructed an assistant to inject the chickens with a fresh culture from the bacteria before a holiday. But the assistant, however, forgot. And when the assistant returned a month later, he carried out Pasteur's wishes. And the chickens, while showing mild signs of the disease, had survived. And when they were healthy again, Pasteur injected them with the fresh bacteria. The chickens did not become ill. So he eventually reasoned the factor that made the bacteria less deadly was exposure to oxygen. So that must be where they got it from. Cool. So in 1880, they began studying rabies. A Parisian veterinarian sent Louis Pasteur samples from two dogs that had died of rabies. So the number of rabid dogs had increased in Paris, and veterinarians had become concerned about the problem. Pasteur began careful work on the rabies and attempting to infect other animals with rabies and identify the site and cause of the infection. One of the difficulties with studying rabies is that the time between introduction of the infectious agent and the signs of the disease varied greatly. Pasteur was able to advance his studies by shortening the period. First, he selected the most lethal fast-acting strains of the virus. And second, he injected the infectious material directly into the rabbit brains. So in the wild, the virus is introduced by it getting bit. And then it slowly moves up to the brain. Pasteur would continue to work with rabies over the next several years until his successful, he came up with a vaccine in 1885. Didn't we go over rabies before? And it's only four shots now that you get instead of, was it that 30 shots or whatever it was? For people, it's only four shots in the stomach. If left untreated, it does cause the person, and people actually do get the foaming at the mouth. They become aggressive, and I hate to say the word zombie-like, but it's the way they act, all erratic. And that's when it goes to the brain, and eventually you will die from it. Oh, crap. I missed one. In 1881, Carlos Finlay presented the paper, The Mosquito Hypothetically Considered as a Transmitting Agent of Yellow Fever. And that was, he wrote that to Havana's Academy of Sciences. And the first to correctly identify mosquitoes as the ultimate source of the disease. Finley's theory, however, was initially ridiculed, and it was accepted only when a U.S. Army scientist working under Walter Reed demonstrated that he was correct. But it was two decades later. So in 1881, pneumococcal bacterium was discovered. So Louis Pasteur and a U.S. Army physician, George Miller Sternberg, both independently discovered the Streptococcus pneumoniae bacterium that is responsible for pneumonia and meningitis, as well as other illnesses. And they look pretty cool. They look like, Bobby, do you have the link open on your computer?
No, but I can.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, look at the picture of it. It looks like a little Hot Wheels minus the car part. It's got the four big, I don't know, maybe just I'm easily amused, but it looks kind of cool. In 1881, England uses vaccine from calves. Boy, these people go back and forth, whether or not they want to use cows, calves, you know, horses, monkeys. Good Lord. The government production of non-humanized vaccine lymph by serial propagation in calves began in London, and then the vaccine was distributed to public vaccinators. I swear, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Just stick with one way and go with it. In 1881, the view of smallpox progression. So these heliotypes give a detailed view of the progression of smallpox. Oh, see, this is one I hate. If anybody wants this link to the history of vaccines, just type up historyofvaccines.org, and it actually has little videos, and some are little, it has pictures of how the smallpox progresses or any of these other illnesses, and it shows it. So it shows the progression of smallpox from just after the eruption of the pustule to the late scabbing stage. And the publisher noted that the patient made a full recovery. And so the, and this is also with chickenpox as well. And I'm sure it's with measles too. The extent of the patient's rash suggests he was left with significant scarring. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I have two permanent chickenpox scars, and I had them all over. I got one on my right below my shoulder, and right on my forehead, right at the hairline. That's the only two that I have. So I guess it all depends, one, if you scratch them, like you're not supposed to, but depending on if you leave them alone, you shouldn't have scarring. Okay. So in 1881, a landmark anthrax vaccine study was done. Hold on one second. What is she? My dog is chewing on something and she's looking at me. Like what? Sorry, I got sidetracked. So they started an anthrax study. And the result of Pasteur's large study of anthrax vaccination in livestock became evident and in dramatic public demonstrations in a test of his vaccine created by attenuating the anthrax bacteria with carbolic acid, all 25 of the unvaccinated animals died. Only one of the vaccinated animals died. Likely as a result of pregnancy miscarriage rather than anthrax. Okay. Oh, they used a cow. My bad. I'm thinking. Okay. In 1882, anti-vaccination arguments spread. So this is where the anti-vaxxers came out, guys. The Anti-Vaccination League of America held its first meeting in New York. Among the assertions made by the speakers at the meeting was the idea that smallpox was spread not by contagion, but by filth. This became a popular, though incorrect, argument of anti-vaxxers. So yes, it is true that a lot of people who have, one, poor health care, poor living conditions, are more prone to getting different viruses, bacteria and stuff, but illnesses have no income level. They don't have, you know, anybody could get sick with anything, no matter who you are. So, but being clean does help. And 1882, tuberculosis, Robert Koch isolates and cultures bacilli. He announced his discovery of the agent that caused tuberculosis. For a time, it was called Koch's bacillus. Today, it's called Mycobacterium tuberculosis. TB was a widespread deadly disease in the 1800s. As Koch said when he presented his findings, 1 in 7 of all human beings die from tuberculosis. If one only considers the productive middle-aged groups, tuberculosis carries away 1/3 and often more. And he began to work on a vaccine for treatment and prevention of tuberculosis. And 1905, Koch would win the Nobel Peace Prize in physiology or medicine for his investigation and discoveries in relation to tuberculosis. Most people that get tuberculosis a lot. Now, this is only from my experience that I saw when I was in South Florida. There was a high homeless population that had TB. And then a lot of migrant families that had three, four families in one under one roof, and it's poor ventilation and close proximity is why they got a lot. I'm not sure about other areas, but that was one of the bigger things that I've noticed. In 1883, a bacterium was identified. Edwin Klebs, a Swiss German pathologist, identified and described the bacterium that causes diphtheria. It was known as the first as Klebs loafer bacterium. The bacterium's club-shaped appearance helped Klebs differentiate it from other microbes. Later, the bacterium became known as the microsporon diphthericum bacillus. Jesus, Marie. Bacillus diphtheriae or Mycobacterium diphtheriae, as it is now called, Cornobacterium diphtheriae. Good, boy, that's a mouthful. You guys are awful quiet. Any questions so far?
I'm here.
Lorna?
Free beer, Lorna.
Only if you're vaccinated and then you get one from Budweiser. So in 1884, attenuating the rabies virus. Having tried to attenuate the rabies virus in monkeys, Pasteur turned to a different method to produce the vaccine. So he observed a flask, open on both ends, in which his protege, Emile Roux, had suspended a piece of rabbit spinal cord. Okay. Pasteur predicted that dying of the infected tissue might weaken the virus. Indeed, later experiments showed exactly this. Pasteur was able to use a series of less attenuated vaccines over several days to prevent rabies in dogs that had been infected. The work was dangerous. He and his assistants often had to handle the rabbit animals and take samples. I hope they had muzzles on. If they had muzzles back in the day. Oh, wow. So cholera made jump ship and went to Egypt. In 1883, Egyptian investigations into cholera started. Louis Thulier, a biologist, went to – he was sent to Egypt by Louis Pasteur with other French scientists to investigate a cholera outbreak. Oh, wait a minute. That was it. Hold on. Okay. So somebody died at 27 years old of cholera, but it doesn't say the person's name. So Robert Koch had arrived with his own group of German researchers in Egypt in late August. Both teams were attempting to isolate the causative agent of cholera and to infect experimental animals with the disease. Neither team succeeded, and the French scientists returned home. Koch, however, left Egypt for Calcutta, India, to investigate cholera there. All right. Oh, I skipped one. My bad. In 1884, Loeffler's contributions, Frederick Loeffler, a German bacteriologist, was the first to cultivate the diphtheria. He used a set of rules that we now know as Koch's postulates to confirm that the coronae bacterium diphtheriae was the agent that caused diphtheria. Later in 1884, he showed that C. diphtheriae produces a toxin. And this is the first description of a bacterial exotoxin. So an exotoxin is a toxin that's excreted into the surrounding environment by a microbe. So when C. diphtheriae colonizes the upper respiratory tract, the bacteria secrete a toxin that injures and then destroys the cells. The waste products and proteins form a thick gray substance called a pseudomembrane over the pharynx, and the pseudomembrane sticks to tissues and obstructs your breathing. So meanwhile, the toxin can travel to your heart, your muscle, the kidneys, liver, and other areas. Robert Koch and Friedrich Loeffler formed the basis for identifying a disease-causing agent. The microbe is presented in every case of the disease. A microbe can be then taken from the host and grown independently, and the disease can be produced by introducing a pure culture of the microbe in a healthy host. And four, the microbe can be isolated and identified from the host infected from step three. So they were on their way. In 1884, Koch isolates bacillus. In a letter from India describing his research there, announced his discovery of the agent that causes cholera. For a time, it was called Koch's bacillus, as was tuberculosis. As Koch's comma bacillus, Filippo Pacini had achieved this feat in 1854, but nobody really knew it was him that did it. I'd hate to have the name Koch. It just doesn't sound right. In 1884, rabies success with dogs announced. Pasteur announced to the French Academy of Sciences that he had successfully protected dogs from fatal rabies by use of his attenuated rabies vaccine. Let's see. We're getting there. In 1885, they had another success with the rabies vaccine. So Pescher repeated his rabies vaccinations on a shepherd who had been severely bitten by a rabid dog. And it was also successful. After he published the word of the success, people fearing rabies from animal bites began to seek him out for the series of vaccinations. Anti-vaxxers, or what we would call it today, oh, my bad, it wasn't anti-vaxxer. It's an anti-vis-a-vis, I cannot pronounce this word, PETA, what it is now. I can't, it's a vis-a-vis,
come on, chop, but chop it up.
It's anti-vis-a-vis-vectionist, whatever, it's PETA, objected to his use of animal experimentation. So I guess PETA came around back then too. See, I thought PETA was something that just came out in the 1990s or, you know, good Lord. Okay. In 1885, boys were sent to France for a rabies vaccine. In Newark, New Jersey, four boys were bitten by a rabid dog. A fundraising effort arose to help send the boys to France for treatment. And they raised $1,000. Wow, that's a lot. To send them overseas on an ocean liner. The healthy boys returned home in January. And after treatment with the new rabies vaccine, the long incubation period of the rabies virus gave the boys enough time to travel thousands of miles for the post-exposure vaccine. I don't know really what the incubation period is for rabies. For people, I should say. In
1885, when I had to hold on to that beaver when it bit my dog, it was 10 days.
10 days? Okay.
Yeah.
Before it's supposed to show signs?
I believe so.
Oh, okay, cool. I wonder if it took them 10 days to get there. By boat. Think about it. By ocean liner, how long it took them boys to get there?
From where to where?
hold on, let me go back to it. They were sent to France from Newark, New Jersey.
Okay, sailor boy, that's your answer.
Huh?
I said, hey, sailor boy, that would be your neck of the woods, figuring out how long it would take to get from Jersey to France.
Yeah, how long would it take?
By ship?
Like a week, huh?
By ship?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd have to say, like, maybe 5 days.
Okay. Yeah, it's not battleship, you know. And I don't know how fast ocean liners go, really.
Especially back then.
Yeah, I know. So in 1885, American physician Joseph O'Dwyer introduced intubation for treatment of obstructed larynx in patients with diphtheria. Not only did he describe the method for the procedure, but he developed instruments to perform it. Within a short time, intubation largely replaced the tracheotomy in treatment with diphtheria with airway blockage. He died a few years later from a heart ailment brought on by none other than diphtheria. So they think he probably got it from one of his patients when he intubated him. Which comes back to the same thing of sterilizing equipment, you know, the sterile field and all of that, you know. And the thing is, with intubation, you're not always going to be in a sterile field because EMTs or paramedics have to do it out in the field, you know, and things like that. Let's see. In 1885, Ferrand's vaccine for cholera. Oh, crap. Spanish physician Jaime Ferrand developed a live attenuated cholera vaccine. His vaccine was the first to immunize humans against a bacterial disease. Ferrand had worked on veterinary medicine vaccines in Spain following Pasteur's publications on the attenuation of microbes. He created the cholera vaccine by cultivating bacteria taken from the waste of a person with cholera and growing the bacteria on nutrient culture at room temperature. That must have smelled lovely. The material was then readministered to the subjects via 1 to 3 injections in the arm. Ferrand was soon requested to go to Valencia, where he vaccinated about 50,000 people during a cholera epidemic. Scientific commissions soon descended on Valencia to evaluate the efficacy of the vaccine. And the reports were mixed, with some declaring that Ferrand had succeeded and others said it was not effective, kind of like today. Ferrand was widely criticized for attempting to keep the method of creating his vaccine secret. In his defense, he asserted that he needed compensation for the creation of the vaccine to support his studies and his families. And during the rest of his career, Ferrand would develop vaccines for the plague, tetanus, typhus, tuberculosis, and rabies. So I guess there's more than one. In 1885, sporadic epidemics continued. Though smallpox disease rates dropped throughout the 19th century due to vaccination, suspicion about vaccination remained among some of the populations. This led to devastating epidemics when the disease reappeared. French Canadians were among those whose mistrust of vaccination would end up costing them dearly when in 1885, poor policies regarding hospital patients resulted in an epidemic in Montreal. So the disease smolders here and there, and when the conditions are favorable, it becomes an epidemic. And this was well illustrated by the Montreal outbreak of 85. For several years, there had been no smallpox in the city, and a large unprotected population grew up among the French Canadians, many of whom were opposed to vaccination. And so on February 28th, a Pullman car conductor who had traveled from Chicago was admitted into the Hotel Dieu, the civic smallpox hospital being closed at the time. Isolation was not carried out. And on the 1st of April, a servant in the hospital died of smallpox following her disease. It was almost 3,200 people died of smallpox in Montreal. Okay. And 1885, rabies vaccines were used in humans. I thought they just used it on the little boys. So Pasteur successfully prevented rabies in a 9-year-old, Joseph Meister, by post-exposure vaccination. Meister's mother brought the boy, severely bitten by a rabid dog, to Pasteur in the hopes of preventing the disease. Several factors made Pasteur's potential involvement in the boy's care controversial. He had never before successfully used the vaccine on a human. He had treated one other person. It was a 10-year-old girl, and she got one injection, and then she died before she could even get the second one. And the concept of attenuation of viruses and bacteria was still in its infancy at that time and injecting a human with a disease agent, even a weakened one, was a new and controversial action. Pasteur was not a medical doctor and might have faced some serious consequences had Meister not survived the injections. Well, shit, I thought he was a doctor. He went to med school. So Pasteur felt certain the boy would die from rabies infection if he did nothing. So he began the course of 13 injections, one each day, of vaccine made from rabbit nervous system tissue. And so each injection contained a less attenuated virus. And he never developed rabies. So it worked. Okay. In 1888, Rue and Yersin investigate the diphtheria bacterium. Emile Rue and Alexandre Yersin showed that a substance produced by C. diphtheriae caused symptoms of diphtheria in animals. So later on, they described the procedure. Broth in which the organisms had grown for several days was filtered through unglazed porcelain. The sterile filtrate caused death following its injection into animals in the same manner as that of the living organisms themselves. Moreover, the membrane characteristic of human diphtheria and the intense local inflammation, edema, and hemorrhage could often be reported or reproduced by the toxins. So they're still working on it. Okay. In 1890, antitoxin and serum therapy was started. This dude, Chiasato, I am not butchering his first name, and Emil von Behring immunized guinea pigs with heat-treated diphtheria toxins. Chiasato and von Behring showed that the blood products of the guinea pigs contained a substance that prevented the harmful effects of C. diphtheriae and its toxin when the guinea pigs were re-exposed to lethal doses of the bacteria and toxin. And next they showed that they could cure diphtheria in an animal by injecting them with a serum of immunized animal. And they called the substance antitoxin. And their treatment was serum therapy. And they realized they needed to immunize large animals, such as horses and sheep, to produce enough antitoxin to protect humans. Moving right along. All right, hold on one second. Okay, so in 1891, there were advances in vaccine production. English physician Montkin Copeman showed that adding glycerin to lymph acts as a germicide. As glycerin came to be widely used, it reduced transmission of harmful microbes via the lymph. And hold on a second. So here is the steps that he took. A red heifer calf, about 2 months old, in good flesh and health, is placed upon a bench in a special operating room and strapped on its side with one hind leg fastened vertically. They just got the stuff from him, from the heifer. It's kind of in depth in how they did it. So let me see the bottom here. So basically they did the same thing like they did with the cowpox, same thing. They took some of the lymph from it and they used it. In In 1891, Koch's test failed for tuberculosis. His attempts to treat people with preparations of tuberculin were published to disappointment. No real difference emerged, experimental and control group patients. Pfeiffer discovers bacterium. German physician Richard Pfeiffer, once a student of Robert Koch, isolated a bacterium from the lungs and sputum of influenza patients during a pandemic. Pfeiffer believed that he had found the cause of influenza, and the bacterium, they called it Pfeiffer influenza bacillus. In the 1930s, it was definitively established that influenza was, in fact, caused by a virus, not a bacterium. Pfeiffer's influenza bacillus, however, would eventually be named Haemophilus influenzae because of its longstanding, though incorrect, association with influenza. That's the Hib, by the way. Okay, in 1892, the relationship between chickenpox and shingles suggested. A Hungarian professor of pediatrics, James Boke, described cases of chickenpox developing individuals who had been in contact with shingles. I'd like to bring up the question of whether or not the unknown infectious material of chickenpox could, under certain circumstances, manifest itself instead of a generalized skin eruption as a zoster eruption. He seems to be the first to have documented his suspicions about a connection between chickenpox and shingles. And it would be nearly three decades before it would be proven correct. And that's when they he started inoculating children with the vesicular fluid from shingles. Okay. Did they not come out with the chickenpox vaccine not too long ago?
Well, yeah.
I don't think they had it when I was a kid.
60s, 70s.
I don't
think apparently they came out with it in 1892. They took the shingles fluid and to produce the chickenpox vaccine. Okie dokie. I thought they came out, apparently they lost it. In 1893, the New York inauguration, a new building for the Pasteur Institute in New York City was inaugurated. This Pasteur Institute appears not to have been officially connected to the Institute Pasteur in Paris. Rather, it was privately established entity that provided rabies treatment and other kinds of medieval medical services. From its opening in December of 1889 to January of 1900, almost 1,400 patients were treated at the Institute under the direction of Dr. Paul Guibert. Of these 1,367, nine died from rabies, notwithstanding the Pasteur treatment, a mortality of 0.65. The mortality rate of rabies without treatment will vary from 5 to 95%. Well, no kidding. I mean, that's, why don't you just say it's 100% if you either die or you don't? So in 1893, low vaccination rates lead to outbreaks. In Muncie, Indiana, smallpox outbreak illustrated the effect of lower vaccination rates on the spread of the disease. A local physician noted that vaccination there had been largely neglected since the last epidemic of smallpox in 1876. So the initial cases appeared in a family in which only one member had been vaccinated. Physicians were unsure whether the disease was smallpox or chickenpox and established a quarantine too late to control the disease spread. Despite measures that included near quarantine of the city, fumigation of mail, cancellation of public gatherings, and compulsory vaccination. The epidemic spread from May of 1893 through October. In the end, 140 people contracted smallpox and 20 people died from it. But approximately 13,000 people were vaccinated during that one particular epidemic. And one possible death resulting from post-vaccination tetanus infection. Also, don't forget, when you get a vaccination of whatever, if you were exposed to that particular illness, you could still get sick because it takes about 2 weeks for your body to say, oh, crap, I'm sick, and it'll fight it off. Your white blood cells will fight it off. But if you're already exposed to it, yeah, you're going to get it anyway. But you may not get it as bad. So just remember that. In 1893, cholera came out again. Hafkin's Indian vaccine trials. Waldemar Hafkin arrived in India to conduct tests of his cholera vaccine. In his trials, he employed control and experimental groups, a relatively new practice for the time, and vaccinated more than 40,000 people. Though he's always not able to maintain rigorous controls, his methods would become useful models for future vaccine trials. His vaccine showed efficacy in many of the trial subgroups. By the mid-1896, Hafkin had concluded that the use of the initial attenuated vaccine was unnecessary, and so his trials continued. He tested only one more potent vaccine. And the other thing is, when you have new medications that come out, also new vaccines of whatever kind, it takes roughly 10 to 15 years to for it to pass trials, to get to human trials. That's why, in all honesty, that's why I'm like, on this one, because it hasn't been that long. In 1894, early use of antitoxin in the United States for the diphtheria antitoxin. Two young Cincinnati physicians treated a two-year-old girl successfully with the diphtheria antitoxin. This is one of the earliest documented uses of diphtheria antitoxin in the United States. G.J. Herman and Charles Woe Reynolds learned that a local physician had obtained some of the serum on a recent trip to Europe, and they begged him to let them use it to treat four children and one family who had taken ill. And the physician had enough antitoxin to give only the youngest child, whose disease had not progressed far. The little girl and one of her untreated brothers survived, but two of the untreated children died. A lot of times, it also depends on your immune system. Okay. So in 1894, New York regulates antitoxin. The New York City Board of Health told the health department to devise a plan to ensure the purity and potency of diphtheria antitoxin sold in the city. At this point, most of the antitoxin came from two suppliers in Germany. All right. So in 1884, the first polio epidemic started. The first major documented polio outbreak in the United States occurred in Rutland County, Vermont. 18 people died and 132 cases of permanent paralysis were reported. Charles Caverly noted the appearance of acute nervous system disease in the county, and he was one of the first physicians to recognize that polio could occur with or without paralysis. And he didn't assume, however, that the disease could be spread from person to person. The contagious nature of polio would be established in 1905. And I don't know if you guys knew this. They used to have the live drops, and now they have the actual injection. This is what I was told when my kids got their polio vaccines, because they still gave the drops under the tongue. They told us that none of our kids could go around anybody with chemo, what was undergoing chemo, who had cancer, because it's an actual live polio vaccine. And their aunt at the time was undergoing chemo, and they had to wait. I can't remember how long it was, but they had to wait. And so this was back in 95, I believe they just started coming out with, oh no, don't do this to me. Uh-oh. Sorry, guys. Technical difficulties. My computer's been going retarded here. Let's see. In 1896, we're almost there, guys. in 1896, Cole's contribution to cholera. William Cole developed a heat-inactivated cholera vaccine that came to serve as a model for cholera vaccines in the next century. Cole was, at the time, an assistant to Robert Koch, and he went on to work on Rinderpest, leprosy, and other diseases, and ended his career at the Institute for Experimental Therapy in Frankfurt. In 1896, the basis for typhoid vaccination is established. As with many discoveries in medical history, several different researchers were working on the idea of protection against typhoid fever. At the same time in the 1890s, in Germany, Richard Pfeiffer and Willem Kohl in 1896 demonstrated that inoculation with killed typhoid bacteria resulted in human immunity against typhoid fever. Almroth Wright published a paper a few months later in 1897 in which he described a similar finding. Reading before the Harvey Society of New York in February of 1913, U.S. Army physician Frederick Russell stated that the publication of Pfeiffer and Cole's investigation antedates Wright's paper by some months, giving credit for the demonstration of typhoid immunity via inoculation to Pfeiffer and Cole. Wow, they were having a pissing contest, I guess, over who discovered it first. Wright, however, would be the first to develop an effective typhoid vaccine. The following year, Russell developed the first U.S. typhoid fever vaccine in 1909. In November to December of 1881, issue of Reviews of Infectious Diseases, Groschel and Robert B. Homick conducted a review of original literature related to the typhoid vaccine and argued that Wright and Pfeiffer, in particular, should share the credit for the vaccine. Okay. In 1896, the Hib bacterium influenzae, in Atlas and Principles of Bacteriology, Carl Lehmann and Rudolf Newman referred to as what would eventually be named Haemophilus influenzae as bacterium influenzae, crediting Richard Pfeiffer for its discovery. The book included a colorized smear of a nasal secretion containing the bacteria. Look, Lorna, it's got pictures. Is Lorna still here? Does she check out?
I'm still here.
Yeah, so they have color pictures in this.
You woke her up.
Can I color them?
You woke her up.
If you want. And you know, we should make coloring books for kids, I swear to God. In the 1897, bacterium mistakenly blamed for yellow fever. Ah, here it goes. Italian bacteriologist Giuseppe Senarelli, a prominent researcher in this field, announced that a bacillus bacterium was the cause of yellow fever. Initial investigations seemed to bear this out. However, the United States Army surgeon Walter Reed, oh, that's how they got Walter Reed Hospital. There you go. Eventually demonstrated that Santarelli's bacillus isteroids was a secondary invader and was not the cause of yellow fever. I always wonder how all these military hospitals get their names. So Walter Reed got its name after that Army surgeon. There you know, your bit of useless knowledge for the day. In 1897, German scientist Paul Ehrlich, who would win the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1908 for his work on immunity, developed a standardized unit of measure for diphtheria antitoxin. Ehrlich's development resulted from his recognition that the amount of antitoxin in serum varied greatly among different samples. Physicians could not depend on the potency of any given container of antitoxin when treating a patient because the containers had no common standard for potency. Ehrlich's immunity unit marked the first standardization of a biological product and paved the way for future work with this sera, whatever that means. In 1898, Britain banned arm-to-arm vaccine transmission. Arm-to-arm smallpox vaccine transmission was banned in Great Britain. As the Royal Commission of 1896 noted, lymph from cows was safer than human lymph, which sometimes contributed to the spread of diseases such as syphilis and hepatitis. That makes sense. Because whatever that person has, it's going to be in that infectious material. So bovine vaccines eliminated the danger of human infections being passed from the lymph material. Countries on the continent had been steadily moving to use animal vaccine since the 1860s. Kind of like my drill sergeant said, you don't want to catch that gonorrhea or herpes. In 1898, the regulation of vaccine supply increases. As smallpox rates declined, the apparent need for vaccinations was less pressing, and the occasional adverse reactions to vaccination became more visible. At the same time, developments such as the addition of glycerin to vaccine lymph, the increasing regulation of pharmaceutical suppliers, and the advancements of microbiology led to the generally increasing safety of the vaccine supply. See, all vaccines have to have certain things in order to make them work. So, like mercury, they used to use, but apparently they just started putting, what the hell is it called, 4-hydroxybutyl in it. It's very toxic, but to the body. I don't understand why they're using it, but it's the new mercury of vaccinations. So I hope that's just for this COVID vaccine and not others. But they have to have something to help keep it from getting contaminated. So they have to have certain I'm going to skip that one. Okay. In 1899, early typhoid vaccines were used by the British military. The British Army used early forms of the typhoid vaccine during the Second World War in Southern Africa. Okay, this says Boer. B-O-E-R. What the hell is a Boer War in Southern Africa? Nearly 15,000 soldiers were immunized. Among these men were approximately 11 cases of typhoid fever per 1,000 soldiers. In contrast, unimmunized soldiers was about 31 cases per 1,000 soldiers. Typhoid vaccine would become an important part of military life. Mandatory typhoid vaccination for a division of 15,000 men in the United States Army began in 1911 with the mandate to expand to all soldiers only a few months later. So the vast impact on typhoid fever incidents would become evident during World War I just 15 years earlier. At the beginning of the Spanish-American War, there were about 2,000 typhoid fever deaths and at 5 training camps alone. Wow. And compared to only 280 battlefield deaths for the entire war. In contrast with typhoid vaccination in full use during World War I, there were only 227 typhoid fever deaths among more than 4 million American soldiers. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is where mandatory vaccinations came out for the military. And pretty much it's line up, don't ask questions, you get stuck. And I swear to God, we got stuck like 5 different times. And as they say, nut to butt, but they had to change it when women joined the Army to heel to toe. Like the toe of your shoe, your boot would touch the heel of their boot. I mean, literally, you were like sniffing their hair and you would walk. And there'd be like 4 or 5 different nurses stations and basic. And each one would stick you with something and you were not allowed to ask either. So I have no idea what they stuck us with. Finally made it to 1900. Holy crap. In 1900, U.S. Army researchers discovered the cause of yellow fever, spurred by the massive yellow fever-related casualties in the Spanish-American War. Members of the U.S. Army Yellow Fever Commission, headed by Walter Reed, traveled to Cuba to study the disease. Commission member Jesse Lazar met Henry Rose Carter, a surgeon who had studied the incubation period of yellow fever. Carter gave Lazar a draft of paper he'd authored defining the incubation period of the disease as it ranged of 10 to 17 days. And that's usually incubation period for most of your diseases anyway. Lazar reportedly stated that Carter's date, should they prove to be correct, suggested that a living host for yellow fever, determined to uncover the source of the illness, the commission members visited Carlos Finlay and decided to test the theory of mosquito transmission. Holy crap, that's awful long. So that's how they did it. So in 1901, contamination led to stronger regulations. A Camden, New Jersey tetanus outbreak was linked to contaminated smallpox vaccines. This incident, along with St. Louis, Missouri tetanus outbreak, traced to contaminated diphtheria antitoxin. See, that's what I was talking about. That's why you have some vaccines that have to be refrigerated and some don't. Some come in multi-dose vials, and it's the constant. I know the needles are sterile when they come out, but they're still exposed to the air when you take the cap off. So that's why on the multi-dose vials, that they run that risk of contamination. In 1901, mosquito control efforts reduced disease cases. With the approval of Walter Reed, Chief Sanitary Officer Dr. William Crawford Jorgis began to study the effects of removing the Aedes aegypti mosquito population on yellow fever rates. He started his work in Havana in February. Workers drained or covered open water containers and fumigated areas to kill adult mosquitoes. yellow fever cases began to drop, and by October, there was no yellow fever. I don't know if they ever did this in your states, guys. I know in South Florida, back in the 80s, when they started this, they used to actually spray for mosquitoes in the evening in South Florida. Did they ever do that in your state, or have you ever seen that done?
Yeah, we used to chase behind it on our bicycles in my hometown.
Really?
Yeah, seriously.
Did you think it was a water truck?
No, it was actually smoke.
Oh,
it was cool to ride behind it.
Oh, that's what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
No, it was actually a pesticide or something. Hey, that could be what's wrong with me. Good God. But, yeah, literally they went up and down every single street and sprayed for mosquitoes. Because mosquitoes in South Florida, oh, my God, it's horrible. In southeast Georgia, if you're in the Okefenokee Swamp, I swear to God, these are radioactive mosquitoes. But they look like horseflies, but they're mosquitoes. And they're called greenheads. And them little bastards, forget it. Did I cover that? Oh, yeah, and the antitoxin contamination. Children died from it, from the contaminated diphtheria antitoxin in St. Louis. 13 kids died from it. Investigation showed that a horse used in diphtheria antitoxin production, the horse had died from it. So instead of the antitoxin being discarded, some of the antitoxin produced from the diseased horse was sent to physicians. This incident, along with a Camden, New Jersey tetanus outbreak, linked to contaminated smallpox vaccine. So, yeah, they didn't care. So they just gave it to another doctor to give it out. Does some of this sound familiar, guys? So what they're doing now. In 1902, the Biologics Control Act, the U.S. Congress passed an act to regulate the sale of viruses, serums, toxins, and analogous products, later referred to as the Biologics Control Act. Even though biologics never appeared to be anywhere in the law, this was the first modern federal legislation to control the quality of drugs, and this act emerged as, in part, as a response to the 1901 contamination. So, and that's when they started paying attention. In 1904, attenuation of bacterium for tuberculosis. French researcher Albert Calmette acquired the M. bovis strain of tuberculosis, which had been isolated from the milk of an infected cow. In 1908, the Institute of Pasteur in Lille, France, he and veterinarian Jean-Marie Camille began attenuating M. bovis by passing it through a growth medium they had developed specifically for this purpose. Their immediate goal was to weaken the bacteria to the point where they could no longer kill a guinea pig. In the end, the researchers hoped to produce a strain of the bacillus that would safely confer immunity to an unaffected host. And it would be 13 years before they saw the fruits of their efforts. See, it takes years and years to make vaccines. And it took them 13 years for that one. In 1904, anti-mosquito methods allow completion of the Panama Canal. William Gorgas brought the mosquito control methods he practiced in Havana 4 years earlier to Panama, where the U.S. was attempting to complete the Panama Canal. Efforts to screen windows and doors, fumigate houses, and prevent mosquitoes from breeding in standing water proved fruitful. The last case of yellow fever in Panama was reported the following year. Well, cool. I'm going to skip down because I don't think we're going to get to all of these. I'm going to skip down. We've got more cholera. Let's see, more tuberculosis, whooping cough. In 1906, whooping cough bacteria isolated. Belgian scientists Jules Bordet and Octave Gengeau isolated the bacterium Bordetella pertussis, the causative agent of pertussis, which they had first observed in 1900. And it would also come to be known as the Bordet-Gengeau bacillus. It's a mouthful talking about these people's names. Poliovirus was identified in 1908. In Vienna, Karl Landsteiner and Erwin Popper announced that the infectious agent in polio was a virus. Popper and Landsteiner deduced the viral nature of polio by carefully filtering preparations of spinal cord fluid from a person who had died of polio. The filters were known to trap bacteria. When Popper and Landsteiner injected the filtered preparations into monkeys, the monkeys developed polio. The researchers then concluded that infectious particles smaller than bacteria caused the disease. And Lorna, here's another coloring page for you. Polio itself would not be visible to researchers until the 1950s when the electron microscope was invented. See, they got lots of pictures. The debut of Typhoid Mary.
Now, are they colored pictures, or can I color them?
No, you can color them. They're black and white. It's some are like, you know, gray, but you can still color them.
All right, cool.
Mary Mallon was first referred to as Typhoid Mary by the New York American on June 20th, 1909. Mallon, an Irish immigrant who worked as a cook for wealthy New York families, first gained the attention of public health officials in 1906. A Long Island family whom Mallon had worked as a cook had fallen ill with typhoid fever. Though Mallon was no longer with the family, officials trying to locate her discovered that other families she'd worked for had also developed typhoid. Well, damn. In one outbreak at a household of nine, in Dark Harbor, Maine, in 1902, Mallon and Mr. Coleman Drayton, head of the household, were the only two not to fall ill. Drayton had contracted typhoid a few years before. Major George Soper of the United States Army, after investigating Mallon's past some years, noted, eventually Mary Mallon became for... Oh, she was a carrier. That's why. I was going to say. So she was a carrier. So she didn't get sick with it. She just gave it to everybody else. Wow. Ain't that nice? In 1907, she was detained by the New York City Department of Health for 3 years, first at a hospital for contagious diseases in Manhattan, and then at Riverside Hospital on North Brothers Island in East River, to be kept in isolation. She was released in 1910 under the conditions that she would no longer work as a cook and would take steps into preventing spreading typhoid. But in 1915, she was caught once again working as a cook. This time she used the name Mary Brown. And she was sent back to North Brother Island and remained there for the next 23 years. Good God, I thought that was a joke, the Typhoid Mary. She was blamed for 10 outbreaks of typhoid fever. Wow. Learn something new, right? Let's see, polio, cholera. I'm looking for some newer, but we've gone over 1,000 times. 1914, typhoid vaccination becomes commonplace. Yellow fever, typhoid, measles, measles, polio. Okay, 1918. Influenza, Spanish influenza pandemic and vaccines. And the deadly Spanish influenza pandemic of 1918 and 1919, investigators attempted to develop vaccines to prevent influenza. Though they had not yet correctly identified the causative pathogen, a variety of killed wholesale bacterial vaccines were tested. These vaccines included Bacillus influenzae, also now known as Haemophilus influenzae, and strains of pneumococcus, streptococcus, staphylococcus, and Moraxella, Caterhalis, whatever. No, I could say freaking staphylococcus, but I can't say the other one. Good Lord. These vaccines would certainly not have prevented an influenza infection. As we know now, the pandemic was caused by a new strain of the influenza. Influenza viruses would not be isolated and identified until the 30s, and the first commercial influenza vaccines were not licensed in the United States until the 40s. So that's the big Spanish influenza pandemic. I lost 4 people in one family from that pandemic. A mother, father, and 2 kids died from it. Freeze-dried vaccine used in tropical climates. Let's see. I'm just looking for more. Okay. In 1921, the first human test of BCG, Albert Calmette and Camille Guérin began their first test of their attenuated tuberculosis bacilli in humans. Their preparation is called Bacillus Calmette Guérin, or BCG. In shorthand, BCG is a weakened form of tuberculosis bacterium that causes the disease in cows. Okay. And then in 1921, FDR got polio, and then he's the one that was paralyzed. In 1922, school vaccination requirements had been started. By this time, many United States schools required smallpox vaccination before children could attend. Some students and their families, however, sought the help of the courts to avoid the requirement. Such was considered by the U.S. Supreme Court when Rosalind Zucht, a student from San Antonio, Texas, was excluded from a public school for failure to present proof of vaccination. The complaint alleged that the city ordinances requiring vaccination to attend public school violated due process and the equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment. The court dismissed the writ of error that brought the case to them, stating that the constitutional question presented was not substantial in character, and citing previous cases which had determined that a city ordinance was a law of the state and that it was within the police power of a state to provide for compulsory vaccination. And there you go, guys. Use that as your reason for not getting the vaccine so your kids can go back to school. In 1922. Don't get me wrong, guys. If you want to get the vaccine, that's up to you. Do your research and make sure. And I'm not talking about just the COVID vaccine. I'm talking about all of them. Like myself, I can no longer take vaccines unless I super, super, super research it, because the last one almost killed me. And so that's why I will not be one of the many to take it.
I'm not putting a vaccine in my arm that a magnet sticks to. That's kind of creepy.
They found out that's not true.
No, it
some
is.
Guy,
it is true.
Is, well, see,
it
I,
is 100%, well, it's 100% true, because my sister-in-law just did it, and it stuck to her arm.
Oh, did it really?
Yeah.
And you saw her? You saw it? Wow.
Yeah, a picture of it. Yeah.
Oh wow. Because Somebody said that what they were doing is because they were anti-vaxxers, they would wet the person's arm and take a magnet and stick it to their arm and it would stick. But some guy, I don't know who this person is, got a hold of all four vaccines, okay, and gave them to a lab. And two of them, I don't know which one it is now, two of them they tested with the magnet and none of the material stuck to the magnet. Now, I don't know however true that is. I have no idea. But I'm not getting it. I refuse.
Now, there's no reason whatsoever for my brother or sister not to lie.
Not true. No. I didn't know that you actually saw it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I can send
you the picture.
Oh, I don't care. I trust you. I don't care. People are saying it like, oh, look, you're just faking it and all this other shit. So I actually took a magnet and I stuck it to my dog because she's chipped with one of the little microchips. Problem is, I don't know where she's chipped on her neck. And I tried it and I think there's just too much skin and it's too thick, unlike a person's arm, you know, and her hair is thicker. So it wouldn't work. I tried. But now
my dad and his wife got the vaccine and it didn't stick to them, and my cousin got the vaccine. But I don't know if it was the first shot, the second shot. I have no idea.
Okay. Did they get the same one?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. No, because it could be.
I just found all this stuff out tonight, so I haven't had a chance to talk to them.
Because it could be one of the four, you know what I'm saying? It could be like, to say, the AstraZeneca, I don't know. And the other one, the parents or whoever got the Johnson & Johnson. My mom got the Johnson & Johnson. So far, so good with her, but she's got lupus. Well, they think she has lupus, and she has hypothyroidism, and they're worried she's going to go into Hashimoto's and stuff. So, I mean, I begged her not to get it, but, I mean, she did. She got her second one, I think. But I found an article where it could take up to 48 days or 48 weeks. I can't remember what it was. Hold on. I know it was here. Oh, shit. Nope. That was when I was having technical difficulties. I'll find that article again. It was either 48 days or 48 weeks after they get the injection of the vaccine is where they're going to start seeing problems. There's a doctor. She's a virologist, and she was talking about how it's not making people sick in certain ways. It attacks your immune system. And that's where the problem lies. They just don't know the effects. So, and it's not being an anti-vaxxer. I'm just anti-stupid. So, all right, enough of that little spiel. Let's see. We've only got 15 more. I'm not going to get them all done, but that's all right. HIB is linked to meningitis. American researcher Margaret Pittman classified different types of Haemophilus influenzae bacteria and found that strains that caused meningitis had a capsule composed of a specific polysaccharide, a form of carbohydrate that has many sugars like linked together. And of those strains, she found that type B caused nearly all cases of Haemophilus influenza meningitis, and would later be confirmed that HIB could also cause many other serious diseases. Oh, see, I thought HIB was just your, well, okay. My son's friend, he went to college with, she got bacterial meningitis, and she died 3 days later. So when I say if you guys are getting sick or whatever, and it's not normal, go to your doctor, because a lot of times it could kill you. Yeah, I'm not going to have time. Bobby, there's like, I'm not even to 1950 yet, and I got maybe 100 more of these things to say. I'm like, good God, vaccines have come a long way. Yeah, I'll have to, I could finish
right.
it up. Jesus, I've got another whole show of, damn, I didn't realize that, because I'm only on 1931. And I skipped like 15 other ones, but it was other, you know, so-and-so died, so-and-so, nah, I'm not, it's not a, no big deal. But I'm at 1931, and there's probably another 100 of them. So I will continue this. Hey, next Tuesday, I'll use it
there
for the medical show. We'll think of something for the Monday night show. But, yeah, that's just, wow.
It is Tuesday today, right?
Yeah, what I mean for next Monday show.
All day to midnight.
Yeah. I was going to do the masks and stuff. I guess I could just cover it really quick. So there are different things about the masks. The thing is, some doctors are talking about the blue surgical masks. Those are not meant to be worn over and over and over again. They're fine if you go into the doctor's office, grab one out of the box, put it on, and then leave, you check out the trash. That is perfectly fine because that's what they're meant for. You know, when you go in, if you're sick, and this is, I'm talking any other time. You know, when you go to the doctor's office, they're saying if you're coughing or sneezing, put a mask on. Okay, perfectly fine to wear a mask in that situation. But reusing the blue surgical masks are not good. So throw them away, period. Now, the fabric masks, everybody knows, you know, people doing the vape with them and blowing the smoke through them. They were smoking cigarettes through them. Look, they don't stop shit. And in all seriousness, they don't. It might cut back on some of the spit mist if you're standing that damn close to somebody. Which is, I just don't fathom, I don't understand why they want you to, people to wear a mask, if there's hardly anybody around you. You know what I'm saying? It's like, which more and more is coming out that it's all been bullshit. You know what I'm saying? Between Fauci and the CDC, they keep going back and forth. And some jackass is actually wearing three masks.
Did you see the video where they put the mask underwater and worms started coming around?
No. From the mask?
Yeah. From the mask.
Oh, that's gross.
Yeah, and it goes
what
into
kind?
Your lungs and it causes some, I don't know, they're brown. They're trying to pass it off as fibers, but fibers don't squirm around.
Yeah. Oh, okay, that must be the one that was made. Okay.
Yeah. And then it causes some kind of lung disease. It starts with an M. I can't remember the name of it.
M?
Yeah, with an M.
Well, there's
as
meningitis,
mama.
But...
No, that
well,
wasn't
meningitis.
It.
Myobacterium?
That could be.
Mycobacterium pneumonia.
And that's, I've seen that a week or so ago, so I don't know where to find it.
See, here's the thing. I have looked at multiple sources to find out. Okay, and everywhere you go, you're going to get both sides. And they say it's been debunked that wearing a mask will cause pneumonia. Okay, well then tell that to the people that actually got it. Now.
Right.
And who got the sores. But here's the thing. With the people that get the sores or the rash, they could be allergic to whatever's in the mask. or the fibers irritate them. At that point in time, they should not have to be allowed to be forced to wear a mask because it could be
right.
an allergy. So, and not to mention the N95 masks, those have to be fitted to your face. So, because it has to make a complete seal around it. So, yes.
Yeah, you can't do that when the guys have beards.
I know. What's the point of wearing a mask? And people were told they had to shave. And I'd be like, bullshit, I am not shaving. If I was some of these guys, some of the guys wouldn't do it. See, here, this is from this doctor. He said, depending on the materials used, may cause allergies, itchiness, and redness to the skin. And custom cloth masks eventually accumulate sweat, makeup, beauty products, if you have lotion or whatever, automotive exhaust, pollen, and other particles in the air. That's part of the problem. And then if you touch your mask to situate it, you know what I'm saying, and touch products in the store or whatever, and you touch your face, that's the stupidity of why I'm wearing a mask.
Exactly.
I mean, as a medical professional, we're told not to touch, don't touch your face. But here's the thing. When you're in with these highly infectious people of whatever they have, you will not touch your mask. Trust me, you will not. I took care of a Petri dish patient. This dude had TB, scabies, HIV, and one other disease. I don't know what else. He had one other one. You had to wear a hair mat, the hair cap. You know what I'm talking about? The surgical hat. You had to wear one of those, a face mask, the shield, a gown, and the booties, and gloves. Two pair of gloves. Just to take care of him.
Wow.
But that's what I was talking about, the homeless population in Miami. The guy was homeless, and Jackson Memorial takes in a lot of indigent care. And so that's part of the problem. I don't know. I just think common sense is what it takes. You know, if you're in a sporting event, like they finally, the Carolina Hurricanes had their first game of the playoffs last night. 12,000 people were allowed in the stadium. 90% of them did not have masks on. But they didn't make it mandatory to have the vaccine to get in either. So, and in that kind of environment, okay, maybe. Everyone's screaming. Spit comes out, you know what I'm saying? And I could see possibly that environment. Okay, but other than that, I don't. I will laugh at you, and I'm sorry, I will laugh at you if you're outside by yourself walking and you have a mask on.
I know, me too.
I'm sorry. I have seen people riding a bike wearing a mask. I just can't fathom the stupidity of some people. Good Lord, if you're outside and the wind blows, you don't have to worry about it. Yeah, and it's like, okay, whatever. Whatever. And now, have you seen the newest thing about Republicans? The liberal snowflakes. Well, freaking crap. Everything just crashed.
Oh, no.
Shit. I'm glad the show's over. Now I got to freaking find a way to turn my final paper in. But anywho, liberal snowflakes, they get the vaccine. They said you could go without the mask, right? They're like, oh, my God, I don't want to go without a mask because I don't want to be mistaken for a Republican.
Wait.
You know what I'm saying? How could you have so much hatred for somebody that you don't even know? You know what I'm saying? It's like, wow, your life is pathetic.
Brainwashed.
To be like that. Huh?
Brainwashed.
Dude, that's beyond brainwashed.
Tide pod eater.
Idiot syndrome.
Yeah, Tide Pod Eaters.
Idiot.
Yeah, anytime
syndrome.
I see...
What?
All I gotta say is it's just sad. If you have to live your life to hate someone because you don't want to be seen as a Republican. And I usually just tell people, that's okay, keep your mask on. We don't need to see your ugly face. And
right.
I'm telling you, I am
all
pissed
right,
off.
We got
yeah,
2 minutes.
People. Go ahead.
All right.
Do your
thank
thing.
You again for another great show there, Miss Kimberly. And thank you, Miss Wisconsin.
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 Wisconsin signing out.
And again, thank you to all the listeners. God bless America. God bless our children, our veterans, first responders, our troops, and God bless the Defender 7. Everybody have a wonderful night.
Good night.
Good night.